complete? What kind of timeline?
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to engineer.
Maybe you said that, but I'm shuffling papers here to get going.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to City Engineer Pagel on that question.
Mr. Pagel.
We would anticipate construction beginning May or June of 2008. We would need to go through a design process over the next 12 months, get the project memorandums out of the way. But construction would start 08, completion sometime middle of 09.
And Senator Saxhog, you're asking for some of the one-time money. Is that correct? So you're asking for cash and not bonding. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Just so we understand that. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Senator Saxhog. We have Senator Dibble's motion that Senate File 127 be recommended to pass, and it will be referred to the full committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Senator Bakker, are all these doing the same? Senator Bach, is he present? Senator Sieben? I guess we'll keep a lot of bills in the subcommittee. Senator Murphy in his stead, Senate File 580.
Can we go to the next one first?
You want to do the next one first? Senate File 534.
15.
I mean 1534, I'm sorry. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I just lost my witness. Saw him here a second ago.
Mr. Qualley.
All right. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, if I could.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment to, this is the first place this has been heard, so this is an author's amendment to get the bill into the shape that he wishes the subcommittee to consider it. All those in favor of the Dibble motion to amend by the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble, Senate File 1534.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1534 was brought to me by the UTO Railroad Union. And what it does very simply is it asks to create a state rail safety inspector that would assist in inspecting and examining our railway operations for safety purposes. This is something that a number of states do. The intent is not, of course, to supersede or overcome federal authority, but to assist in making sure that we're maintaining railway operations to safety standards, both in the concern of state policy as well as federal policy. The crux of the bill is to ensure that the walkways that employees that work on the railroads where they spend a great deal of their time are well constructed and well maintained and a safe place to be. So the bill sets standards for clearances, sets standards for handrails and the like to make sure that hazards and obstructions and the like are out of the way. It sets up all sorts of geometric standards for the various walkways that occur along tracks and various permutations. And with that, I'd love my
Senator
witness to
Dibble,
be here.
It doesn't seem that we actually have full copies of the bill in our folders. They should have been double-sided.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
We only have every other page of the bill.
I have the copy of the bill that I printed off the internet here. And copies of that.
Do you need to be looking at that? Otherwise, if you could share that so that Senator Jungbauer and I could have it.
Sure. I'll just grab a copy of the bill summary.
They neglected to do the flip side. Thank you. Yeah, it's just 1 through 5, isn't it?
It's not double sided.
We have this. We can. You have to be patient this morning.
Madam Chair.
Of course, with people going home on Thursday afternoon and then many of them not being here on Friday, the duplicating for the bills this morning was very rushed, and it didn't open until 8 o'clock or so. So just bear with us. We will get through this. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have Phil Qualley from the United Transportation Union, who is working on this same initiative in a variety of other states as well. So he can speak to more specifically to some of the provisions of the bill.
Are you going to take us through it, though, Senator Dibble, or would you prefer Mr. Qualley to do that?
Well, I can take you through it. I'll just use my bill summary that I have here.
Okay.
So it creates the position of the rail safety inspector, so it would be a state position, to inspect tracks and railway right-of-way enforced safety requirements and the like, have the authority to issue citations and fines for violations.
This is something done by the Commissioner of Transportation, sets this up and operates in the DOT.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes. The expense for paying for that inspector would come from fees paid by the railroads. The violations could be, if a railroad is found to be in violation, if they participate in they could be exempt from violations if they participate in a safety program. Sets up the schedule of administrative penalties for safety violations, and it creates an appeal process for folks who would like to appeal a penalty that's been assessed. It goes on to, as I mentioned earlier, talk about setting up safe walkways along tracks and trestle bridges and the like, sets up some definitions and some standards. It goes into some significant detail, which we can discuss in detail if that's your pleasure. The overarching goal is, of course, to create walkways standards that are safe for railroad employees who have to walk along these very dangerous areas. It does appropriate $125,000 from the general fund.
But then after that, Senator Dibble, it's paid for by assessments against the railroad?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And so what is $125,000 is to do what?
I think it's seed money to get the implementation of the act and the establishment of the inspector.
How much is it expected that setting up these walkways will eventually cost?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Maybe Mr. Qualley does or can give us the experience in other states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd like to give your testimony now. Senator Dibble, if your testimony is complete.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Senator Dibble, I do have to tell you that if this committee hearing had been later in the day, we would actually have the bill in front of us. But we're told by Senate Index that the even though it's been given a number, we actually don't have it. So we are hearing it informally and can take no action on it. But
okay.
I think this is still the place to hear it.
Right.
And I will let Senator Murphy know that, and he can bring it up into the full committee or keep it in the full committee without further bringing it into this committee.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Makes sense.
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Philip Qualley, and good morning. I'm State Director for the United Transportation Union, representing approximately 1,100 railroad workers in the state of Minnesota. To answer your first question, Madam Chair, regarding the cost, that is a first upfront one-time appropriation and assesses the railroad's ongoing. However, when to answer your first question regarding the cost of the walkway program, I can only measure it as a railroad worker of 25 years in carloads of ballast. And I will tell you that when I look at the subdivisions of track across the state of Minnesota, St. Paul to Worthington and beyond, Duluth over to Grand Forks, Duluth over to Dilworth, I can't imagine that any one subdivision of track would take more than 60 to 80 carloads or 100-ton carloads of screening ballast, which I don't know the exact cost of. I do know that, for example, on one of the railroads in the state, they and that's 3/4-inch ballast, which is the type in 1-inch ballast that we're looking for to create the walkway conditions that are the most safe. And so that said, I know that one of the railroads in the state has their own free source of ballast. And finally, we don't think that the that investment will cost. We think that that will actually lead to a savings because of reduced injuries.
Okay. But there will be some initial cost to construct them. The benefits to be realized later is what you're arguing.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, that's correct.
Well, you can continue with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Today, the United Transportation Union Minnesota Legislative Board brings forward Senate File 1534, the Minnesota Railroad Walkway Safety Act. During a period between, we did have, excuse me, as well, a handout for you. We had an overhead presentation, but I would like to walk through this. This contains a few graphs of injuries. Of the switching operations casualty pyramid. It has photographs of what we're trying to alleviate, and I will not be able to go through those directly with you. I can answer any questions if you'd like. During a period of from January 1st, 2003 to December 31st, 2006, there were 187 non-fatal railroad injuries have occurred to railroad workers in the state of Minnesota. From a study of the United States Federal Railroad Administration and from our own members' testimonials, over 20% of these injuries can be categorized as slip, trip, or fall injuries. The carrier will claim that many of these are behavioral. However, we find that many of these injuries, there are there are many contributing factors: uneven ballast, hazards and obstructions in the walkways, vegetation obstructing the workers' clearance, and other reasons. The carrier has a non-delegable duty to provide a safe working environment. And from our experience running the railroads, the carriers simply do not repair and clean up the safety hazards in a quick enough manner. Where we have safety committees in place at the round and reasonable table of railroad safety, we have seen that the carriers simply do not make the repairs soon enough after the committees identify the hazards. I would like to just simply go to the first picture and point out to you that picture A is a photograph from a locomotive along a main line, and this is good walkway. If you would be so kind as to see that you have track, you have it's 50-mile-an-hour ribbon rail track. You have a ballast shoulder beyond the ties that is by FRA standards an appropriate drop off of ballast at angle. But on the far outside before the vegetations begin, you see a walkway that is for drainage, but also is what our ultimate goal is to see along the right-of-ways of the state of Minnesota. The second hand in the handout is, again, the pyramid. And we go to the SOFA switching analysis. And you'll see that on the bottom of that pyramid in the colored area is the majority of injuries that are not amputations, that are not defined as severe injuries, but again fall into that slip, trip, and fall, the 20% that we are trying to alleviate. You'll go through the rest of the pictures. We've identified different and various hazards that relate in order to the bill. For example, on page four, on page 3, you will see section 4, walkways, bridges, and trestles. Here is a bridge in Savage, Minnesota that has been written up for over 2 years and simply is not repaired by the carrier.
Which picture is that?
It is the third picture, and I'm sorry that these are not numbered.
Let's see.
Pardon me?
Hold it up. So it's got the orange fence.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Moving to the next photograph, we see a walkway condition where the vegetation is right up to the side of the track. And if you move to the following picture, you'll see a conductor trying to navigate that area. This is what we are trying to alleviate. This is very dangerous. You'll see in the next picture vegetation and steel has fallen over the walkway of a main line. And on the following picture, you see that in the autumn, when vegetation dries out and leaves stalks, you can see the size of that stalk next to a worker's boot, and that is an extraordinary tripping hazard. And we respectfully, Madam Chair and committee members, ask you to keep in mind that railroad workers work around the clock, 24 hours a day, oftentimes in the dark without lighting other than ambient background lighting, if any, and that these are significant hazards we can avoid. Moving to the next photograph, we see some outstanding brand new secondary and mainline tracks that were built in Mankato, Minnesota. You see the appropriate drainage and drop off of the class mainline ballast. But then as we go to the next pictures, we see the housekeeping of practices where the private contractor has left bags of debris in the walking area. And if we move to the next photograph, we see that inside those bags is not only dried tumbleweed and vegetation, we see spikes, tie plates, steel appurtenances to the track. It's not acceptable. Our bill seeks to alleviate these type of this conduct. And quite frankly, I'm afraid to say that because of budget constraints on the Class 1 railroads all over the state, it is not unusual to find these type of walking conditions. We move to the next photograph. This is a major classification yard in the city of Minneapolis. And what you see is a walkway worker walking to a hump area where the cars are released on their own gravity. And as we move through those pictures, you'll see the cars moving closer. You'll see the hump from a right angle, at 45-degree angle side. But then at the fourth picture in this series, you'll see that where the person stops from pulling pins on those cars, you see the type of drainage and deterioration of the hump area. And this has been reported for at least 1 year. If that worker is pulling the pin on those cars and should take a fall or a tumble, as he falls under the weight of his own body downward, and this is what he's going to have to navigate. We look for this to be improved. Moving to another set of photographs at Mankato, Minnesota, you'll see rotten grain and feed and silica sand between and on the sides of rails. Our bill seeks that this be cleaned up. As we move close, and I will tell you that to step in this stuff creates a hazard of once your foot has this material on it, it becomes a slipping hazard on your feet. As we move closer, going down the same track to a tank car, we see a small shadowed triangle of a broken tie or a tie butt sticking up. That is an unacceptable tripping hazard. As we move finally to the last picture in this series, we see what railroad workers navigate on a regular basis, that anywhere in any given spot on the railroad, but in this particular yard, here where you would step off of a safety appliance on a rolling stock or a grain hopper, this is the type of feed and rotten grain that's sitting in the yards. And I remind the work, respectfully, Madam Chair, that when this grain heats up, it becomes a breathing danger because of the heat in the summertime. And there are viruses. And in the wintertime, that is covered with snow. We don't know it's there. Finally, the last photograph in the sequence refers to a piece of the bill. I guess I've moved down without referring sections. I apologize, Madam Chair, but going to Section 9, tracks, walkways by tracks and yards, industry turnouts and spotting areas, we see a photograph of the litter and of the upkeep of that yard. And finally, this photograph here we look at, when we look at turnouts, we would hope that our bill would contribute to a better walking surface, elimination of vegetation, and cleanup. Moving to the last photograph here, and I'll probably cut this short, we look at northern Minnesota in Proctor, where the railroads have gone through the yards and eliminated tracks, but for years now have left the track switch rails in. This is an unnecessary hazard that we believe that really the state has an interest in providing a safe workplace for workers, and that there we set standards that these be removed to eliminate injuries. I will simply close, Madam Chair, I guess, by saying that again, we think that the cost, the upfront cost of this bill is minimal compared to the potential savings and alleviation of human misery. The state has an interest to provide a safe work environment for workers. We have given the short lines a break here. They are not assessed for the cost of the inspector, and the commissioner can allow the short lines to be, apply for the MnSharp type counseling program, where rather than being fined, they can be apply for coaching and finally, I'd like to point out that the state of Wisconsin has three state rail safety inspectors on an equivalent number of track. The state of Illinois has six rail inspectors on 7,000 miles of track. And the state of Iowa has two state rail safety inspectors on approximately identical number of tracks. The Wisconsin state inspectors the railroads are assessed a ton tax. The Iowa state inspectors are a general appropriation on an ongoing basis. And Illinois state inspectors are paid for by the railroads on a mileage fee. Regarding the always present question of federal preemption, always the question in the railroad business, we do not believe that this bill is federally preempted. This bill has been crafted out of identical language from the state of Nevada and California, and those laws, as I understand it, were upheld in federal court, the Ninth District. We look forward to a rigorous
debate. Are those the only two states that have this walkway safety part of it? I understand that others, as you indicate here, have safety inspectors, but are those the only two states where a similar law has passed?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, committee members. You're correct. 30 states have state safety inspectors. This law is, as I understand it, is in California. The walkway safety law is in California, Nevada, Oregon, and Tennessee. I understand, but have not confirmed, that Illinois may also have a walkway safety law. And if that is in fact the case, and again, I've not had a chance to confirm this information, I understand that that walkway law is in suit as to the preemption issue by the North Fulk and Southern Railroad. However, the North Fulk and it's my understanding that when that law was created, there was a sign-off or an agreement with the other carriers that operate in the state, and that the North Fulk and Southern does not operate in the state of Minnesota. So to answer your question, I can confirm California, Nevada, Oregon, and the state of Tennessee.
Thank you. So there are 30 states that have station inspectors, four that currently have a law. Are there other places, Mr. Qualley or Senator Dibble, where such legislation is being considered this year?
Yes, Madam Chair, I understand there are a number of states where this is being brought forward at the UTU's initiative. I'm not sure what states those are. I assume you know.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, I am aware of the state of Kentucky.
Kentucky. Senator Dibble, I don't see, I know that you make an appropriation and that there is a means by which looks like similar to the Wisconsin model for the carriers to be assessed to pay the upfront costs. Is there a fiscal note? Do you have a fiscal note on this bill? I don't see one. Okay. By the time when you hear the bill in the full committee, we'll have the full fiscal note.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Are there questions? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Qualley, you mentioned that this type of legislation is in effect in other states. Is it the same specifications that are spelled out in this particular legislation that are in other states, or is this better, worse?
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, Senators, it is essentially the same. In this bill was the history of the language of the bill, and it is in the second section of the on the walkway piece, beginning on page 3 at section 4. That is essentially identical to the language that has been passed and into law in the walkway bill that is on the books in the state of Nevada. So to answer your question, it is essentially the same. The history of this language, as I understand it, is it originated in California. And then that type of language was used in the state of Oregon and the state of Nevada, and I was told that the Nevada was really the best and most concise language to be available to the states. So I hope I'm answering your question.
So it's the Nevada language that you're mostly using as a model here?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions? As I indicated, we don't have the bill formally before us because session starting after. So, Senator Dibble, when the bill is in the full committee, you will need to attach the amendment. Okay, so we really can't do
yes,
it here.
Oh, yes, that makes
okay.
sense. Yes, Madam Chair.
So
All right.
I don't want you to forget to
thank you.
Do that.
Yeah, thanks
so,
for the reminder.
So, Senator Dibble and Mr. Qualley, thank you very much for the presentation.
Yeah,
is
Chair,
there anyone who wants
know,
to
there are...
comment on the bill?
I'm pretty sure there are.
we did not receive any, I don't believe, we didn't receive any names, but.
I did speak, Madam Chair, with Mr. Appitz over the weekend. He indicated he was going to come forward on behalf
okay.
of BNSF, not enamored with the bill. And MnDOT's here, I don't know if they intend.
Senator Carlson, do you have a question first?
Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble or our guest here.
Mr. Qualley,
is there a mechanism set up for the complaint to be registered with the owner of the track? And is there, do you feel that there needs to be a method there to either qualify or give a priority of some of the problems? For instance, I think there were some of them that were maybe the organics, you know, the sticks and growth around the area, and some of them where you need to remove some of the tripping hazards, the steel. There was the bridge that needed to be repaired. Is there a priority system that you're thinking of setting up, and how would these complaints be actually logged?
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you very much. In 1995 and 1996, the state of Minnesota abolished the Transportation Regulation Board. And with that abolishment, MnDOT, as I understand it, received powers under statutes between 218 and 222 for administrative hearing services. And so an appeals process to any fine or assessment of that nature would go through the administrative hearing process. And from there, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the remedy is a civil or district court beyond that. As far as the actual priorities, I can tell you, as state director vested with responsibility the safety of my members and looking at our industry and my knowledge from safety groups, the people who are subordinate to my legislative representatives, I would say it as a priority. We clean up the steel off of the right-of-ways that are littering the right-of-ways, walkways. We assure the clear vegetation and that the debris is set forward in, I believe, Section 4, the feed, the granule particles, the pellet materials, the revenue freight that has dropped onto the track and the walkways be removed. Then that is statewide. Then I think the key is to go to a smoothing program of existing uneven ballast, and then we go finally to the walkway ballast program where we set down better walkways as provided in the different sections in the crafting of this bill, which are specific in areas and locations on the railroad. So I hope that answers your question, and thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll take other testimony. If there's anyone who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill, join Senator Dibble at the witness table. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please,
for
the record.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Sweeney. I'm legislative counsel for BNSF Railway Company. Paul, here to testify in opposition to this bill. I don't know if any of the members present were there 2 years ago, but at a hearing on another Mr. Qualley's bills 2 years ago, Senator Murphy admonished us at great length and made it very clear that he did not want these bills to come to this committee and to have these labor management squabbles fought at Transportation Committee. He said, from now on, we're supposed to deal with these things outside of the room and try to resolve them among ourselves before coming here. We agree with that policy, but unfortunately, here we are again 2 years later. We were assured that this subject would be discussed with us. It wasn't. We're still not sure that we've seen the bill.
Mr. Sweeney, any member of this legislature can bring a bill to the Senate, have it introduced, and have it discussed, and that is what is happening here. So I would ask you to speak to the substance of the bill and not to the legitimate process that brings the bill before us.
Yes, Senator, I will. And my complaint was not with the senator. It was with the person who brought the bill to him.
We do not tolerate attacks on any witnesses by anybody, whether it is another witness or another senator. Not in this committee, sir.
Yes, Senator, I apologize. We do remain, however, willing to discuss this subject with the UTU. We have done it in Illinois in the past, as recently as 2 years ago. The industry worked with the United Transportation Union and the state regulators to come up with a reasonable, workable solution to the situation. We would propose that the committee direct that the parties engage in such a conversation and come up with a practical solution rather than the bill which does have several problems. One is the magnitude of the problem. My company, representing about one-third of the rail industry in the state, had a total of 9 injuries attributable to slip, trip, and fall last year. And that's for all classes of employees, not just members of that particular union, but for all employees. If I trip on a carpet leaving here, that would be counted as a slip, trip, and fall injury. So this is based on the presumption that there is a widespread problem and that this large body of regulation and law that is being proposed would take care of that problem. I think the first thing is to get a grasp onto what exactly is the magnitude of the problem and to identify a practical solution to that. We think that these incredibly detailed requirements that are going to cost a great deal of money, they would in effect require my company to construct thousands of miles of walkways along the track. We have 1,600 miles of track in the state of Minnesota, not including the yard tracks. We do have walkways and surfaces along much of that right-of-way, but this would require that we do considerably more at significant cost. It would create a new bureaucracy to oversee this. It would create a new tax to finance the bureaucracy to oversee this. And this, again, is assuming that all of the 9 injuries that occurred on my company last year or the 10 that occurred the previous year would be addressed and prevented by this. It seems to be a wholly disproportionate and incredibly expensive solution in light of what's been done in other states, notably Illinois, where a practical solution that the United Transportation Union agreed to was developed. So we urge that the dialogue that we've been requested to have take place, and we propose that the DOT be involved in that as the administrative agency that would be given oversight to make sure that there is a good, real effort made to, number one, identify what the problem is, and number two, come up with a reasonable solution. That has worked before. We've done it in other states, and there is no reason that it can't happen here. In response to a couple of the questions that came up earlier, in terms of the cost, it's impossible, not having really seen this or had a chance to look at the entire impact on the railroad, but it would be a significant cost. There's no question about it. In terms of the tax, I believe it was shown that Wisconsin assesses some sort of a ton-mile tax to finance rail inspectors. I represented my company in the state of Wisconsin for several years. I'm unaware of any such tax. There may be a mistake there. I will double-check. But I checked with my counterpart at Union Pacific Railroad. He is also unaware of this tax. Regarding preemption, it's a mixed bag. The circuits are split. The Ninth Circuit has said that it can be done. The Fifth Circuit has said, no, it cannot be done. They have thrown these rules out. So it's up in the air. And the issue is right now in front of the Federal District Court in the Seventh Circuit. So it's hard to give a slam-dunk answer as to whether or not it is or is not preempted. It wasn't mentioned, but the Federal Railroad Administration does have inspectors that have responsibility for this subject matter. Now, labor will say that they need more inspectors than they have now, that they don't have enough to ride herd on the entire industry. But I think it should be noted that the federal government does have inspectors who address many of the subjects and complaints that were raised earlier, and that if there is a problem, that the members of the labor organization are free to contact the FRA and make complaints about perceived safety problems, and in fact, they do. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Are there questions, comments for Mr. Sweeney from the members? Again, you probably have another opportunity to speak about this bill in the full committee.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak either in opposition or support of the bill? Mr. Abbott. Welcome to the committee if you'd identify yourself. And Senator Dibble, since we can't take action on this bill, we are going to try and move along.
All right.
Because there are other bills. And in particular, Senators Bach and Sieben are here, and I want to take their bills up next.
Quite all right, Madam Chair.
Mr. Abbott.
Madam Chair, my name is John Abbott. I'm with the law firm of Messer and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And, Madam Chair, I got the message. If I could just have a page share a little bit of this with you, I'm just going to do a real one-minute primer here. This is some information about Minnesota railroads, and we're really pleased that you've got this subcommittee in the first place. To talk about railroads, waterways, and airports. But here's a little bit of information about railroads. It tells you about every railroad in the state, and it's not the sort of thing that'll keep you up at night. Might help you go to sleep at night, as a matter of fact. But it's useful, and it's on our website as well at minnesotarailroads.com. I'm sorry, and the author should get one, too.
We'll have one for First Senator Dibble up here.
Excellent. Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Abbott's.
As Mr. Qualley said, the short lines and regionals, the Class 2s and 3s, are potentially exempted from this legislation, but they're not exempted ever from the concern about safety. And I just want to share with the committee an understanding that railroads care about safety, and particularly the safety of their employees, safety of the public as well. It is just primary in our thinking at all times. Let me say, the issue we're wrestling with here is slip and fall, people who could potentially be hurt in the workplace. And if you go back to the numbers that I think Mr. Qualley referenced, I think they're similar to the numbers that I was able to dig up. 3-year period, I think we were talking about anywhere from 10 to 12 of these sorts of incidents per year. Am I correct in that regard? You said 20% of the 186 that took place over 3 years. I know Brian had checked with the Burlington Northern and the numbers that they had run into with about half the railroad employees and about half the track in the state was about 9 in aught 4, 10 in aught 10 or 11. We're roughly talking less than a dozen of these sorts of injuries per year. This is on 5,000 miles of track, and it's with 5,000 rail employees in the state of Minnesota. I submit to you, Madam Chair, that the magnitude and to the author, the magnitude of the problem here may not grow to the level of discussion that we're having with this bill presented before us. That all said, Madam Chair, this has become law in some states. I think in Kentucky, Nevada, and a couple of other states, this became law several years ago when there were issues of consequence and laws were put into place. The most recent one that came to pass, I'll reference real quickly, was in Illinois. And there, the Burlington Northern and the Union Pacific joined with the UTU after a long bit of discussion about how to put together a good framework for regulation and went to the legislature and supported the legislation that was brought forward. Rather than a 7-page bill, their materials turned out to be about 3 pages of rules that dealt with these various sorts of issues and didn't codify them in statute. I suggest, Madam Chair, that we ought to talk about this, and we certainly ought to talk about it before it gets to the committee, but perhaps over the interim. I know the Department of Transportation has an interest in this, and I'm going to bring forward to you some of the other issues that they have with regard to railroads, but we'd suggest to you that might make a whole lot of sense, and I just make that offer to the author, and hopefully we'll have a chance to have further chance to discuss it. It's the size of the problem we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair,
Evans.
My goal is certainly not to get this committee or the full committee bogged down.
Yes.
In a dispute, and of course we will take the railroads up on their offer to have a discussion, see if there's some amicable. Right? So my goal is to deal with a legitimate public policy and safety issue. Mr. Qualley did want to share his view of the statistics in 10 seconds or less.
10 seconds or less. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and my esteemed colleagues I have the highest regard for personally. But we looked at statistics. The FRA breaks down those 187 injuries into approximately 45 to 50 categories, and they're not only slip, trip, and falls, but they are slip, trip, and falls with qualifiers. We came up with around 35 type of injuries that were not getting up and falling out of a chair in a carpeted room. And they were specific, and we have been conservative with our assessments, and it is generally our facts that we brought to the committee today are accepted, I think, in the industry as being accurate. And finally, I do want to point out that we have let the committee, our carriers, know that this bill was coming forward and where we were trying to get our text language from. Although I do, this has come very quickly to the committee, and I thank you for having us today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. If others wish to comment on this bill, I would ask, in the interest of time, that they do so when it's presented in the full committee. So thank you Mr. Quali, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Pagel, and members.
Thank you, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Sweeney, Mr. Appetz, and thanks especially for the CD on railroads. Senator Bach, you have, I need the agenda. Please.
Thank you, Senator.
We have Senate File 1121, your bill on North Shore Express.
Madam Chair, this is our effort to bring passenger rail back to the people of Minnesota from Duluth to the Twin Cities. And we used to have passenger rail. I think it ceased in about 1985. This bill is requesting bond proceeds of $1.7 million, of which $780,000 will be used to purchase and reconstruct a small piece of rail up around Duluth. Will be used in Anoka County for planning, engineering, and environmental work, and then about $500,000 will be used to match federal money for an economic impact study, and the federal money's not in place yet, but we're hopeful that we'll be able to get that. I have with me, Madam Chair, Bob Manzling from the St. Louis and Lake County Rail Authority to speak to the bill and answer any specific questions. Thank you.
Mr. Manzling, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Manzling, the director of the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Rail Authority. I think the senator summed up everything I was going to say, but I have a lot more detail on the specifics to what we're talking about here today. I don't know how specific you'd like to get, but I do have some handouts.
Sure. Paige will distribute them. We also have the sheet, Senator Bach, of the request for the funding. And
Madam Chair,
this is a bond request. This is not the one-time money cash.
Correct, Madam Chair.
You're requesting that this be considered by the Capital Investment
Correct.
Committee eventually. So, Mr. Manzling, if you'd like
Madam
to
Chair, the first item on your list there, the Duluth Transfer Line Railroad for acquisition and reconstruction. That first page gives in detail the land acquisition for the railroad to be purchased in CN Railroad. It goes on that list there to describe the track restoration of 9,700 lineal feet of track and installation of about 500 feet of track. You can open it up and look at the little map inside that shows you exactly where that is in relationship to the overall project. Toward the lower end of the page, you'll see where the mainline BNSF railroad comes into a location called Saunders. We'd like for the railroad then to proceed westerly. It's called Steelton Yard. And northerly along the Duluth Transfer Line Railroad, the one we're acquiring in pink, up to the Duluth Depot. And that, we feel, is a main going to be the main route for the proposed passenger rail service, an important part of this project. Madam Chair, I also have a larger map that shows the entire Duluth Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. You kind of put things in perspective on the overall project.
Okay.
And I don't.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Bach, this is in a sense a completion of a circular route kind of thing within the city.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Or redoing it?
Yeah, I guess maybe the map isn't
real. Explain the connection you need to make.
Madam Chair, if you go to the bottom of the page, you'll see the highlighted yellow line going straight north toward the top of the page.
Yes.
That line exists now, and it passes through the main Burlington Northern Santa Fe Yard in Superior. And you can see where it kind of goes to the west or the left, across the Duluth Harbor, and then again northerly up to the Union Depot. That track is in place. It's usable. But there's two real problems in using it. One is the Burlington Northern Yard in Superior. It takes a lot of time to get a train through that yard. It's a very busy yard. a lot of train traffic, a lot of coal traffic. The second problem is where it crosses the harbor. That's a swing bridge. And boat traffic has a priority there. If you're up there with your fishing boat and you're going through that particular bridge, the bridge will remain open for your fishing boat but be closed for the rail traffic.
So what the proposal here is to, at this at Saunders, is to go west there and then to go north for the passenger line.
Correct.
And is there no track there at this point?
Part of the track is there and part of it's missing. But right now CN does own it, and they do not want to rehab it and repair it. They'd rather sell it and get out from underneath it. There's about 500 feet missing.
And the 1.7, Senator Bach, is for preliminary work on it. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, it includes the purchase of that piece of rail from the CN also, and the cost to reconstruct it, put it back into a usable condition.
So $1.7 million takes care of the whole thing? That sounds pretty cheap.
Excuse me, $780,000 takes care of the whole thing. It's a lot cheaper than that.
Then how come you want, what else do you want that money for, Senator Bob?
Madam Chair, about $500,000 of it is to match federal money or the economic analysis study that we expect to undertake about the whole line, then $400,000 is for Anoka County for a piece of their work.
I see it now on the handout. Thank you very much, Mr. Mazzaline. Senator Bach, we also had Mr. Cerfenik. Is he here? Did he want to testify?
No.
He's here, Madam Chair, but I don't believe he needs to testify.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Mazzaline or Senator Bach? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to ask, we'll be spending some money in Wisconsin. Is that an issue?
Senator Bach or Mr. Mazzaline?
Madam Chair and Senator, from what we can tell, it would not be an issue. But it has been asked. And we're trying to get it straightened out, but we don't think it will be an issue.
And Madam Chair, why is it,
Senator Dibble?
Why is it not an issue? And are we? I mean, is there economic benefit to Wisconsin? Are we wanting Wisconsin to participate as well?
Senator Bach, did you hear Senator Dibble's comment?
Madam Chair, we'll have to look into that.
Okay.
And then, Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble,
this I'm asking these questions because they came up in my subcommittee too. So I guess fair is fair. There's always a lot of question about what's bondable and what's not, and are studies bondable, or is it design that we need to bond for, and et cetera. Do we know the answer to that question?
City Council, do we know the answer to that question?
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, typically studies are not bondable. Their actual capital improvements on the ground within the state of Minnesota are bondable.
Well, Madam Chair, I trust that Senator Langsett will settle all these questions for us.
Okay, are there any other questions? Then Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1121 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Transportation.
Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1121 be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Senator Sieben.
Thank you,
Senator Bach, Mr. Mazzaline. Senator Sieben, we'll take both of your bills. Senate File 223, high-speed rail link between St. Paul and Chicago, and Senate File 351. I believe these two, I know at least one, correct me if I'm wrong, were both of these bills also heard in the Transit Subcommittee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, excuse me, I don't have Senate File. Senate File, first I'll take Senate File 223, which is the high-speed rail line between Chicago and St. Paul's Union Depot, and we're requesting $10 million in bond proceeds to fund the Minnesota share of this project. High-speed rail, as many members know, is has been talked about here at the Capitol for a number of years, but Minnesota has not yet made a significant investment in this transportation system. The major goals of high-speed rail, this is a regional project throughout the entire Midwest, would to connect 3,000 miles of existing rail rights-of-way between rural, small urban, and major metropolitan areas. Chicago would serve as the hub and operate a hub-and-spoke passenger rail system, providing service throughout the Midwest. And it would introduce modern train equipment, so trains would be able to travel at speeds of up to 110 miles per hour. This would mean that service between Chicago and the Union Depot in St. Paul would be cut, or would be reduced to approximately 5.5 hours instead of 8 hours. And there would also be significant improvements in reliability and on-time performance. I'd just like to add that Wisconsin, for example, has made very significant investments in their high-speed rail corridor, and if Minnesota doesn't act soon, we are going to fall behind significantly. With me today is Mike Rogers, who works for Washington County. Additionally, Mayor Paul Hicks was here. He's the mayor of Hastings, but he had to get back to his work. But he was here to express his support. One, I appreciate that the committee is hearing both the high-speed rail and the Red Rock bills together. For members who don't know, there's a significant cost savings because the high-speed rail line is designated to come up through Winona and then on to Red Wing and into the Union Depot. The investments that we make in the high-speed rail will produce significant cost savings for the Red Rock commuter line, which is obviously very important to transportation needs across the eastern metropolitan area, but also the whole state. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike Rogers to explain some more details about the high-speed rail.
Senator Sieben, the amendment that is in the our package, was that adopted in the transit subcommittee?
Madam Chair, Bonnie's shaking her head no, but I thought that it was. So
why don't we? Ms. Berezovsky, would you explain, please?
Madam Chair, I believe my recollection is that I added, at the direction of the transit subdivision lines 1.9 to 1.12, to what was actually adopted in the first in the transit subdivision. And I thought a delete all would be easier rather than the various different amendments that were being put on in the different subdivisions and subcommittees.
Senator Sieben, since this isn't the first committee, why don't we hear from your testifier, and then we'll go back and adopt the amendment, and we can have a more explanation for it so that when the bill is in the full committee, it'll be exactly the way you want it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Mike Rogers. I'm a transportation planner for Washington County, and I wanted to express Washington County's support for this bill, not only because it connects the Twin Cities to the greater Midwest, but because of what Senator Sieben had mentioned before, and that it shares the same corridor with Red Rock, which is a very important corridor for Washington County. Senator Sieben had mentioned that there would be significant cost savings. Looking at the 2001 feasibility study for Red Rock and the high-speed rail study that was recently completed, there's probably a 20 to 25% on the conservative side cost savings if we were able to implement high-speed rail in Red Rock. So that really adds up down the road in the order of $100 million down the road, $2010. So it really does add up. A couple other things that I think are important for high-speed rail is that it adds new service between the Twin Cities and Chicago. It's service on top of what we have today, which is just the Empire Builder. It would add 6 trains a day. It gets you there in 5.5 hours, downtown to downtown. So that's a big change.
What is it currently?
How long? 8 hours.
8 hours.
And that's if you're lucky and it's on time.
Lucky.
So it's a huge benefit to connect us, and the hassles of going to the airport and checking all your bags and doing the same on the other end, it really makes it time competitive. So it's a very important system to keep going. And on the other end, Washington County and the Red Rock Corridor are supporting federal legislation to try and get some federal money for this corridor from Minnesota to, so we can use the state dollars and match some of those federal dollars as well.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Rogers or Senator Sieben? I think we're getting very familiar with these projects, Senator Sieben, and I, for one, am highly supportive of your efforts and that of Senator Marcos before you. We do have the delete all amendment. Would you explain? Do you have it, Senator Sieben? Mm-hmm. Okay. What was suggested to be added, which is now taking place in this subcommittee, were lines 1.9. Just that one?
To 1.12.
Oh, to 1.12, that whole sentence. And Senator Sieben, what's the rationale there that the Transit Subcommittee suggested should be added that you're now having in this amendment?
Madam Chair, the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative is an effort on behalf of the various states to establish high-speed rail in the Midwest. And the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative designated the route as the one that is outlined here. So this is just making that language consistent, that the route shall be between Chicago, La Crescent, Red Wing, and the Union Depot.
I'm talking about lines 1.9 through 1.12 that talk about where the money comes to spend. That's what's being added in here.
Actually,
is that what you were saying?
No, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was mistaken on that. That is in the original bill. This just incorporates the various amendments that have
that were suggested
along.
In
yes.
the Transit Committee.
Yes.
Okay. Are there comments or questions for Senator Sieben on Senate File 223? Senator Jungbauer moves the A3 amendment.
Yes.
Is there discussion on it? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 223 as amended before us. Senator Jungbauer moves that Senate File 223 as amended be recommended to pass, and it will then be referred to the full committee. Is there a discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Sieben, on Senate File 223. And now we will hear from you on Senate File 351, which is now before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 351 is a $1.5 million appropriation for the Red Rock Corridor Transitway. And for members, I think members on the committee are familiar, but this the Red Rock Corridor has been also studied for and looked at for a good number of years. It would connect, it would use existing railroad tracks and establish commuter rail between Hastings and the Union Depot in St. Paul. This bill looks at adding the $1.5 million would be used first for the design, construction, and expansion of park and ride lots along the corridor. The idea is that we need to start to build ridership. And just from my experience, I know that the park and ride lots are already reaching capacity on this corridor, and this would help with that expansion of those park and ride lots. And also then it looks at extending the Red Rock Corridor between Hastings and Red Wing. So it will look at whether that is feasible. And there was language that was adopted in the Transportation Committee related to this bill. I don't think that's not reflected in the version that members have before them, but I'm happy
Madam
to
Chair.
Answer questions.
Senator Dibble. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Yeah.
Senator
Dibble. We have your LA going to check with my LA to see if that committee report is available so that members can see those amendments that were added to this bill in the other subdivision.
This is the amendment that was added.
Is it in Ms. Berezovsky, is the amendment that you are that you just handed me, is that reflected in the language in 351 here?
No.
Madam Chair, the committee report, I don't think we had a regular transportation committee yet, so that committee report has not yet been adopted by the full committee, so that's why it's not engrossed into the original bill yet.
Report that, and I think Peter went to see.
So what we're going to do on 351, Senator Sieben, is just consider it informally since we do not have the subcommittee report, and if it is, if that's agreeable.
Sounds good to me, Madam Chair. What the amendment does, members, it just clarifies the language for where the terminus would be, that it's the Union Depot Concourse Multimodal Transit Hub. And then it also makes clarification that that the money requested from the bond proceeds would be used for pre-design and preliminary engineering, which is more consistent with what bonding money is used for. So, again,
Mr. Rogers, did you want to comment on Senate File 351?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, again, Mike Rogers of Washington County. Wanted to express Washington County's support for this bill, also the Red Rock Corridor Commission's support for this bill. Very important, obviously, for Washington County and the Commission to get Red Rock going. And as the Senator said, to not just do studies that are for a long-term improvement, but look at trying to keep those studies going, but putting some improvements into the ground to keep building that ridership to make it a more successful corridor as we go along. The improvements at Union Depot make a lot of sense, and making sure that there's that multimodal connection with Central, with buses, with high-speed rail, with Amtrak, so that we can move people throughout the region.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Is there anybody else that wants to comment, and I should have asked that on your other bill as well, Senator Sieben, on Senate File 351 or Senate File 223? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Both bills in the full committee. Senator Dibble, you are going to present Senate File 580 on behalf of Senator Murphy. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
580 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 580 would ask that, it would require that the Metropolitan Airports Commission not enter into any agreements. It's fairly straightforward. I'll just read from the bill. For that have terms of more than 6 months with carriers that operate out at MSP. If those agreements result in shared concession revenues, a reduction in lease payments, payment of rebates, or otherwise reduces carriers' costs of operation by a total amount in excess of $100 million, unless it's brought here to the legislature and specifically approved in advance of that agreement taking effect. This legislation probably is no mystery, comes forward around the discussion that is currently being undertaken by the MAC to significantly reduce the lease rates out at MSP for the airport carriers there. And, of course, you know, the largest beneficiary of those lease rate reductions and other sorts of fees that are being reduced will go to the tune of about $240 million or so to Northwest Airlines. All the other airlines will participate in much smaller amounts in that, you know, significant enhancement of their revenue. Part of the way in which more money will be generated out of the MAC for the purpose of delivering to those airlines is to increase concession revenues and increase the aircraft carriers take on the concession revenues that are levied against all the other operators, the food operators, the other sorts of service and business operators out at the airport that serve the traveling public. I'll just go through a few points I have about why I think this is appropriate and a wise thing for the legislature to do. So these rate reductions really amount to a tremendous benefit to Northwest Airlines. You know, like I said, $240 million. You know, this is on par with the $270 million loan that was given to them back in 1992, which was part of a larger, what ultimately became a $761 million public financing package. And not all of us were at the legislature at the time, but I'm sure we were all aware of the significant effort to which the legislature underwent to vet that deal and to make sure that there were appropriate public benefits. My concern, Senator Murphy's concern, is that this deal is being done, although by a public body, without that same level of public scrutiny and public debate to ensure that there's the corresponding public benefit. We also bring this in forward in light of the fact that Northwest Airlines is now earning a profit. They're just acquired Mesaba Airlines. They're giving bonuses to their employees. They've just placed a large order for new airplanes. It would be remiss to not mention that there's a recent determination by a judge as a result of a lawsuit brought by citizens as well as affected cities that the MAC is, in fact, obligated to fulfill its obligations around noise insulation and address the impact of the airport on the surrounding communities. And that's, roughly in the same order of magnitude of a similar amount of money, $300 million, I think, about it would take to for the MAC to fulfill its obligations around noise mitigation surrounding community that came forward as a result of their decision to stay at the present location and expand and increase their operations there. Also particularly upsetting to contemplate that much of the funds that will be delivered to the airlines from the MAC could otherwise be used for noise mitigation. It's equally, important to consider that Northwest Airlines over many years has adamantly, steadfastly opposed this noise package, has always been very, very not disposed to the level of noise that the communities have needed and articulated that they need in the capital program that the MAC establishes every year. And Northwest Airlines has a significant role in the establishment of that capital program. There was an effort on the part of MAC Commissioner to insert consideration of the noise relief package into the memorandum of understanding that sets forth the deal points that this rate relief package has to abide by. Northwest Airlines insisted on the removal of that from the memorandum of understanding. That loan given in 1992 that I referenced earlier was the source of, like I said, tremendous legislative negotiation, and some of those items that were agreed to were never fulfilled. It's easy to contemplate that the actual repayment of the loan, though this isn't a direct repayment of the loan through these funds, it is roughly on the same order of magnitude. So it could be considered that the public is now paying back that loan from the MAC. I mentioned noise abatement issues, the Duluth base. We all know that never fulfilled its original promise and hope. The Hibbing engine facility was never built. The reservation center, which is now in Chisholm, scaled back significantly. Another deal point on that loan in 1992 was to keep the corporate headquarters here in Minnesota. That became a bone of contention between the MAC and Northwest Airlines. They tried to keep that out of this deal. We know, of course, for reasons that are more global in nature, Northwest Airlines is unable to keep its employment level in Minnesota at the levels that it had in 1992. Maintaining the hub status, a deal point in the 1992 loan, they tried to keep it out of this deal. And Art Rolnick, the economist at the Federal Reserve, rightly criticized our exposing the public so significantly with public resources, because it was hard to anticipate what exactly would be happening down the road with the airlines. And I think now we know why Art Rolnick was so correct. I mentioned before, MAC is increasing its revenues from other businesses at the airport. This is exactly what's happening at Detroit. Vendors are being asked to pay significantly more for the purpose of delivering more benefit to the airlines. And it's kind of ironic that while the airlines are reducing their level of service that's available through paying a ticket and flying on your airplane, you don't get a meal anymore unless you pay for it. While the traveling public now has to buy their meals at the airport. So not only now do they have to buy their meal, their expensive meal, at the airport, but yes. and they don't get the meal that they used to get that was paid for through the ticket on the airplane itself, but now much of those revenues are going to the airline, so they get more money coming and going there. One of the arguments that the MAC has used to promote this agreement, this rate relief, is to incent Northwest Airlines to connect more flights, so folks who aren't necessarily originating or ending up here in Minnesota but passing through on connecting flights, because we become a lower cost operator, they would have more ability to move more of their planes through here. That creates more noise. And again, where is the consideration for the larger public benefit, specifically the noise package? For years now, we as those who represent the noise-affected communities have come to the MAC year in and year out and asked the MAC to work creatively, roll up their sleeves, figure out what sort of financing tools might be available, whether it's through sales tax on site or passenger facility or whatever, you know, whatever it might take to generate the $250 to $300 million it would to fulfill its noise obligations, and have only been met with a lot of resistance. So it's particularly interesting that now we have an amazingly creative way of developing more revenues for the purpose of delivering to Northwest Airlines. Another argument is that this proposal would create more airline competitiveness at the airport, and I just don't see it in this. A few gates might be made more available at one or two of the concourses, but one of the other deal points in this is extending their leases out to 2020. Northwest Airlines controls 80% of the flights. That's up from 70% back in 1992. As far as I know, the 2020 plan that was articulated a couple of years ago by the governor and the chair of the MAC, and then subsequently endorsed by the full MAC, is not off the table, and that would basically allow the entire Lindbergh, the large terminal, to be operated by Northwest Airlines and its SkyTeam partners, and cause all the other minor airlines to be moved over to the Humphrey terminal, the smaller terminal. And so the question needs to be asked, and I'm not sure that it has been asked. That's why we would need. We'd like to have some opportunity to take a look at deals like this. What sort of moving expense is incurred by the MAC if, in fact, it's going to cause those smaller carriers to move over to the Humphrey, if it's at the same time extending their leases to 2020? The MAC already is a low-cost facility. It's in the lower half, has been. It's bragged for many years about how it's a low-cost facility. So now it's lowering it. So it's arguably already competitive on fees and leases and the like. The legislative auditor's report from a couple of years ago affirms that in numerous of its findings and statements. Its average costs per emplanement, its landing fees, all of that in the lower half of similar airports across the country. And, it needs to be said, a couple of things need to be said. This is not anti-Northwest Airlines. Northwest Airlines is an important employer. They're also an important link that we have to the rest of the world. It's great that we have direct flights from here to most other major cities around the country. We do pay a premium, 50% more in our tickets than a lot of other places pay, but people think that that's a worthy trade-off. Some don't, but others do. It is arguably a benefit, and it's important to say that the MAC is a well-run facility. I do think that the legislative auditor did find that there was an appropriate level of legislative scrutiny that doesn't occur with the MAC and its appointments. There's an attempt by yourself, Madam Chair, to bring that issue forward out of the legislative auditor's report, and that was met with great resistance by the administration, so that was not further pursued. And the legislature has, you know, significant precedent to look to in oversight of major, major financial and economic decisions that the MAC undertakes. You know, and the greatest example, of course, is the 1992 loan that it made in the $750 million public financing package that was a part of that. You know, the IRRRB has given $15 million in loan guarantees as a part of that deal. We've given fairly significant tens of million dollars in tax breaks to the airlines, to Northwest Airlines. That was all subject to legislative oversight and scrutiny and debate. So we just believe that this is a significant enough deal that delivers significant economic benefit to a major employer, has significant public policy implications, that it's worth scrutinizing in this arena as well. That's Senator Murphy's and my bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Are there questions or comments to Senator Dibble before we hear the additional testimony? Senator Youngbaugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, I think you made some good points there. It's an extremely large amount of money to not go through the legislative process and the numerous hearings and hurdles it would have to go through at this kind of a level. And it does occur to me that it seems to be that a large amount of money benefiting one Minnesota company at, you know, perhaps to the detriment of other Minnesota companies. But I guess my major concern is always whether we've done something like this before. Have we set a precedent? And I think you made a pretty good case, and I imagine other people will try to make an equal and opposite case that we don't have a precedent for this kind of thing, but I think you kind of set in motion, so I'm assuming you were trying to say that this is a secondary bailout and we have a precedent set of legislative oversight on this type of an issue before.
Yes, Senator Youngbaugh, I think we do have significant precedent, particularly when we're talking about, you know, this kind of money. You know, we're talking about $240 million to one airline in particular. The whole package, I think, is about $270 million. The legislature has brought the MAC over, and the MAC has asked the legislature for some participation when we've considered these significant loans, huge construction programs that have gone on out of the MAC. The whole decision to keep the airport at its present location for the purpose of saving, arguably, $1 billion, although I don't know if those savings were actually ever realized, because I think we're going to end up spending over $2 point some billion at the current facility. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to decide that maybe that was a wash. But, I think that alone sets the precedent for bringing these kind of major financial decisions, whether or not these are state appropriations. Keep in mind the airport at its present location, or whether it were to be built at a new location, would have been done entirely through passenger facility charges and airport generated revenues. But significant enough public policy implications are there so that there maybe need to be a larger arena in which we consider the upsides and the downsides. This may be the greatest idea in the world, and I would be at the front of the parade touting its benefits if I had the opportunity to really examine and contemplate those questions.
Senator Dibble, if this agreement just went on without any legislative oversight on one side of the issue, or interference on characterized interference on the other side, and it got stopped in its tracks, what do you think would happen?
I, Madam Chair, I don't know. I'm sure we'll hear from the other side, some fairly gloomy scenarios.
You don't share the gloomy scenarios, or you don't have a scenario of what might happen if.
No. I think a gloomy, a rosy scenario is as likely as a gloomy scenario. Keep in mind that Northwest Airlines is entering a period of profitability, and that's all we read about now in the headlines. However, there are gloomy scenarios available if this proceeds without some sort of scrutiny and some examination of a public benefit that corresponds to the significant amount of money that's being delivered. You know, fulfillment of larger public obligations, we have a judge's decision in hand. I think the courts may consider the fact that this deal is being entered into while another major decision is being contemplated in that arena. Consideration of, are we considering this continued or this enhanced level of exposure to public resources in a major public facility in light of the fact that there may be a major merger in the offing? What's going to happen then in that case to the operations of the major carrier in this market with respect to jobs and operations and presence in the state of Minnesota? I don't know that that's been appropriately examined.
Any other comments? Again, to our questions for Senator Dibble before we move to testimony. Are there people in the audience who would like to speak to Senator Murphy's bill, Senate File 580? Mr. Hamill and others?
At all.
All Senator.
Thanks. How are you?
Mr. Hamill, welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. With me to my left is our chairman, Chair Jack Lanners, appointed by Governor Pawlenty last late July to become the chair of the MAC. Far into the table is Tom Anderson, the Commission's General Counsel.
Mr. Anderson.
All of us have been very much involved in the negotiation process that's been discussed as part of this language in this bill today. We also have a handout, Chair, that does provide members of the committee with a review of the details of the negotiated process we've just completed over the past year or so. And while we won't go through the details and the financial mechanisms of that, just to have that document available, I think, is worthwhile.
Senator Dibble. Before we hear Mr. Hamill's testimony, a question. Has the agreement on these revenues been adopted, Mr. Hamill?
Part of my testimony, Madam Chair, will include a discussion on where we are in our process, but to be very brief and respond to your specific question, we, for the last year, have been involved in a discussion and negotiation.
At this point, I just need a yes or no.
Oh, yes.
Senator Dibble?
I did not get a copy of the handout, Madam Chair.
Oh. So would it be your understanding that this bill, if it passed, would affect other potential agreements, but not the one that you have adopted?
Let me be very clear, Madam Chair. I may have misunderstood. Let me be very clear. What we have done is we have, together with the airline industry, not just Northwest, but all the carriers we're currently involved in, we have come to a memorandum of understanding between the parties that negotiated the agreement. But that agreement has not been officially voted upon by the Commission or adopted by the Commission.
So this legislation could have an impact, still have an impact on that agreement because it is not a completed.
That is correct.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we all are on the understand that this is not something that is prospective. This is something that could have an impact on the negotiations, discussions that are at this point at a memorandum of understanding.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Sorry for the confusion.
That's okay.
Senator Dibble has spoken about a long and a large variety of issues, but let me just take you some of the basic elements of kind of our response to the actual language of the bill and what its intent is. First of all, we do have a memorandum of understanding, an agreement between MAC and the airlines. Let me explain that when I say airlines, because Northwest Airlines has been a key part of this discussion, their role.
Similar to other large hub airports in the United States where a single carrier or maybe two carriers have a dominant role or position within the operation of an airport, Northwest, in fact, is the largest carrier serving Minneapolis-St. Paul today. They are about 80% of our operation, and that grew out of the result of the various mergers and activities between Republic Airlines and Northwest going back to the mid-1980s, when Republic and Northwest were individually about 40% of the operation. The combination of the two carriers together into one Northwest Airlines entity became an 80% share or so. And that's why we are today an airport with a carrier with such a large portion of the overall traffic activity at the airport. This is not an unusual arrangement. And typically, in all of the metropolitan communities where there's a large hub airline operation serving a particular city, you will see that airline company representing the interests of a variety of airlines that serve the airport. In this case, Northwest, speaking on behalf of itself and the other scheduled carriers that serve the Twin Cities, negotiated this MOU, which will lead to final lease documents. In Chicago, you'd find United Airlines in a similar position. In Dallas-Fort Worth, you'd find American in a similar situation. In Delta, you'd find this happening in Atlanta. This is a fairly common negotiating scenario for airline companies. What we have completed during the past year is a conceptual understanding or agreement as to how we're going to modify the lease between the airport authority and the airlines that serve the St. Paul Airport. This is laid out in the memorandum. Understanding or the MOU that's been agreed upon between Northwest on behalf of the carriers and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And we're now in the process of writing those documents and preparing those documents for final airline and airport approval and review, or review and approval. This is a culmination of about a one-year process of basically time-consuming and to some level detail and fairly sophisticated negotiations talking about all aspects of the operation of the airport and its relationship and arrangement with the airline companies that serve the Twin Cities. I would suggest that the effort on the part of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Madam Chair, and the airline is to try to reduce the overall cost of operation for the airlines that serve the Twin Cities, to make Minneapolis-St. Paul a more competitive airport, and to secure our financial position looking forward into the future. And there are two aspects of this negotiation process that are important to keep in mind. One is the MAC was attempting in this process to try to reduce our costs to keep us attractive and competitive. And I think Senator Dibble did mention that, and I think that's a legitimate concern. Minneapolis-St. Paul wants to be one of the lower-cost airports in the nation. We want to be attractive. We want to grow competition in the marketplace. Having said that, and I have to be very frank and tell you that this is partly driven by the fact that Northwest Airlines is in bankruptcy. And since they filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy approximately a year and 4 months ago, they have been working diligently to try to reduce their costs, to be competitive, to survive the bankruptcy process, and to continue their operations in the Twin Cities and be a viable carrier for the future. They have virtually met with every cost center in the airline's operation to include all of their labor unions, all their suppliers, their vendors, and so forth, negotiating cost reductions across the board. And airports are one of those vendors, and as a result, the airline has come to us in an effort to try to reduce some of its cost in Minneapolis-St. Paul. We're not unusual in this process. In fact, all airports that I have regular contact with have been in some form of rate reduction, cost reduction process over the last several years, as United and Delta, now Northwest, U.S. Air have all gone through these bankruptcy scenarios. This is not an unusual situation. In the case of Northwest in particular, Memphis, Tennessee, and Detroit, Michigan, two other Northwest hubs in the United States, have also completed their negotiations with the airline as part of their cost reduction. And both those airports have also made significant cuts in the cost of operations. So this is not an unusual situation. In fact, it's a fairly common activity when airlines and airports get together and discuss lease negotiations and the fees that are charged the airlines to use the airport. Just to give you a sense of the level of intensity of these negotiations and the magnitude of involvement, we've been meeting for the past year. However, I think it's fair to say that during the first 3 to 4 months from last February, a year ago, through midsummer, those meetings were probably at the frequency of 3 or 4 times a month, possibly, maybe even a bit less, a couple hours each session. However, since the 1st of August of last year up through the end of 2006, meeting at least once a week in typically four-hour sessions with substantial preparation beforehand, running a variety of financial models and taking a look at the variety of impacts and so
that these various items under negotiation would have on the airport and the airline. Our entire goal in this process has been to provide and secure the financial future of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, to continue to have competitive, viable air service for the Twin Cities, and quite frankly, to assist in any way we can the survival of Northwest Airlines as it comes out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, hopefully in the midpoint of this year. Our concern, of course, is that we want to maintain the high level of air service to the Twin Cities. It's an important part of the economic fiber of the community, and it's essential, I think, that we have good direct connectivity to domestic markets and to markets around the world. Northwest Airlines provides the largest amount of that activity, given the fact that they're 80% of our operation. When you talk in terms of limiting or looking at agreements of the Airport Authority, there was a comparison made in the discussion that the $270 million loan that was made in 1992 went through substantial scrutiny at the legislature, and that because of the magnitude of this negotiation, that in fact should be the same situation here. There are a couple of significantly different aspects that need to be brought to your attention. First of all, the $270 million loan of 1991-1992 was unprecedented. An airport making a public loan to a private company of that magnitude, 1990s, had never been done, and to the best of my knowledge, has never been done since that time. Setting aside the fact that the value of the 200...
So did we get a good deal, Mr. Hammond?
Madam Chair, I would argue that we did. While there's... I have my critics, including Mr. Rolnick, who was referenced earlier. The fact of the matter is that the $270 million loan, Madam Chair, contributed to the stabilization of Northwest Airlines at a time when they were in a very difficult financial position. That, along with the contribution of the airline employees giving somewhere in the vicinity of 15% of their salary in cuts, provided Northwest Airlines the financial strength to work its way through a potential bankruptcy, to come out the other side of a very tough economic cycle in the industry, and to be, quite frankly, significantly important in the economy of the region. Following the 1992 timeframe and the recovery of the airline, Northwest went on to find and experience some of its most profitable years of operation, one of its largest expansions, and in fact, it's what led us to expand the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, $3 billion. The airport has significant economic impact on the Twin Cities, the state of Minnesota, and the North Central region. While you can challenge consultant reports and analysis, we retain the services of an analyst who looks at airports in general. And that consultant basically calculated that the value of the Minneapolis-St. Paul, the economy of the region, was about $10.5 billion a year. We believe that that $270 million, which, by the way, is still being paid, there's never been a payment missed in all of the years since that financial arrangement, that, in fact, that $270 million resulted in about a $10 billion per year economic contribution to our economy since that time, and as a result, a pretty good investment overall. What's most important, however, is that Northwest has never missed a payment. They continue to make the payments on that financial obligation. This particular negotiation specifically tied Northwest into continuing to make its payments and fulfill its obligations, even though as part of their bankruptcy rights, they can, in fact, reject those payments as part of a reorganization and basically walk away from some of those commitments and obligations. Part of this negotiation was to secure Northwest Airlines, its financial commitments to this community, secure its hub operation in Minneapolis and St. Paul, which we think is critical to our economic future and viability, and also to retain its world headquarters, which provides a certain amount of exposure and prestige, we believe, to the state of Minnesota metropolitan area. So this deal, this negotiation, was more than just cutting a few costs. It was, in fact, attempting to re-secure and recommit previous discussions and so forth to the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and to the people of Minnesota to make have a financial stable future. If I may, Madam Chair, let me offer a couple of thoughts regarding legislative review at the $100 million level, and then we can possibly, if you've got the time, I want to discuss specifics mentioned by Senator Dibble. We can talk about some of those other aspects. Unlike most public agencies, the MAC does not rely upon general tax revenues to support its operation. And also, unlike most government agencies, MAC spends 95% of its time dealing in the public and the private sector. We deal almost exclusively with private companies. Those companies
have to have a response and a business relationship so that, in fact, when there's a need expressed by a private enterprise such as Northwest Airlines or Sun Country Airlines or one of the concessionaires in our terminal facilities need something, they need something with a quick response and, quite frankly, a turnaround, a business transaction, as opposed to a more slowly negotiated process. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that we should not go through some public oversight, that there shouldn't be governance of the MAC. There's no question about that. But airline airport lease negotiations in our business is a relatively routine event that goes on across the country at both large and small airports on a regular basis. It would be highly unusual to have significant oversight in an airline lease negotiation with an airport authority, unlike the loan of 1991, which was an extraordinarily unusual precedent-setting action taken by the state of Minnesota and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. When an airline needs gates, when an airline needs to have certain improvements, it is incumbent upon the airport to respond as quickly and as aggressively as possible in evaluating that request, generating the revenues for that request, and executing those requests. Because of the construction cycles in Minnesota, if we're not able to respond and make decisions quickly and aggressively, we then lose significant time, and significant time loss means that we lose the opportunity for improvements that mean be important to the airlines and businesses that serve the airport. Legislative process, in fact, approval were required for $100 million of expenditure or modification to language and leases. I think you would have to spend substantial time understanding the details of these negotiations in order to come to the ability to make a decision. Meanwhile, the timing for contract negotiations and issuance of contracts to contractors and so forth would lose its momentum. And quite frankly, this particular arrangement may not be completed and presented to you until after the session is expired, in which case I don't know how the legislature would deal with that. But if you wanted to approve this particular deal, it may very well be that you will have finished your session when the final documents are completed and written, which should be somewhere in the area of 1,000 pages. It'll be a significant document with substantial writing and reading necessary to fully understand the agreement. Competition. Senator Dibble he has a solid fundamental knowledge of the airport. He's been a student of the airport and our operation for a very long time. Many of the legislative members who live in South Minneapolis and is around the airport. And I fully understand his concern and interest about dollars and how money is spent at the airport. Let me offer, however, some consideration about noise versus airport dollars. There is no other airport in the United States that has spent more money on a per capita basis as mitigation than the Minneapolis-St. Paul Metropolitan Airports Commission. To date, we spent more than $340 million in the process of home insulation, school insulation, and land acquisitions in an effort to try to provide an environmentally acceptable exposure for the community. There's no question that a large airport located centrally within near residential communities generates noise that causes serious concern for communities. But we believe that the nearly 7,800 homes that have been acoustically mitigated at an average cost of $42,000 per home is a responsible action on the part of the commission to deal with that issue. The acoustical mitigation insulation of 17 schools, all included in the 65 DNL noise contour, have now been completed, we think is a responsible and appropriate action on the part of the airport. And at the request of the City of Ridgefield, the acquisition of some 550 homes that were in the higher impact areas near the airport to be acquired in cooperation with the City of Ridgefield was an appropriate course of action for us to take. The airport is currently working on a program to acoustically mitigate properties outside the 65 contour out to the 60. That is a very controversial issue right now. It's a matter of litigation. But at the end of the day, we are looking at what more can be done. I'm sorry?
Courts ruled against you on that, did they not?
That's right. In fact, Tom Anderson can probably discuss that more intelligently with you as far as the detail of the court determination. But Judge Aldrich has indicated clearly that he believes that the Airports Commission has further obligations to the community regarding noise out to the 60 DNL. An important point on that point, however, Madam Chair, is that the federal government and the
Environmental Protection Agency had determined that the 65 DNL contour and the noise is higher. In other words, 65, 70, 75. Those are areas that are confined to the federal noise impact zone. Outside of 65, the federal government does not recognize it as being a noise exposure area. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, however, we have acknowledged that there is noise exposure outside of 65, and that's why we are talking about 60 DNL. The issue here is not whether there should be some action or some program to mitigate noise. The question is, what should be done? In other communities, and to the best of my knowledge, no community to date has gone outside the 65 DNL contour with specific actions. And in fact, most airports haven't even come close to dealing with the noise impact inside the 65 DNL contour. So when we talk about noise and money invested and time spent, I think we have a long, well-documented history of trying to deal with noise exposure and noise mitigation. And I think that we have a continuing obligation and need to deal and address with the noise issues, and the Commission will do what's appropriate in the future as well. This $279 million package over the next 15 years, or something less than $20 million a year in rate reduction for the airline companies, is an effort to try to reduce our cost, reduce the cost of government. And quite frankly, Madam Chair, much of the benefit here is due to a change in the methodology, so the way we're going to charge the airlines and the way that they pay the Metropolitan Airports Commission for services rendered. Specifically, under the current methodology, which is based on depreciation and imputed interest, the airlines pay up front, a front-end load for longer-term benefit. Under the negotiation that we've just completed, if this document should be completely approved as negotiated and being written, it would simply go to a debt service arrangement where we would spread those payments over a longer period of time. And what we've learned through our financial modeling and analysis and using outside consultants to do some of this work, we've determined that, in fact, the new methodology is financially a better, more secure financial arrangement for the Metropolitan Airports Commission on a long-term basis. And the reason why is because under the current structure, when you have substantial new construction where you're incurring substantial new debt, the debt depreciation mechanism works very well. But as you finish your construction and move to a more steady maintenance and upkeep arrangement and don't have new capital projects of substantial dollars, that mechanism doesn't work quite as well over the long haul. A more stable debt service arrangement of financial payment does. As a result, we secure longer-term, more stable payments from the airlines for the services and the improvements on the airfield. We can talk about that in more detail, but the concept is that, in fact, we learned in this negotiation that we, in fact, will provide ourselves a better financial performance for the long haul with this new arrangement. And what that means is that we won't collect as much on the front side from the airlines, but rather collect more money, I'm sorry, the required amount of dollars for a longer period of time at a more steady rate. That benefits the Airports Commission and results in some rate reduction for the airlines. So there are a variety of issues in this very complex, involved negotiation that I believe benefit the community, benefit the airport, and benefit the airlines that serve the community. Let me just address for one moment, Madam Chair, the amount of money we're talking about here. We're talking about an agreement that involves some $279 million between now and the year 2020. Northwest Airlines is the primary recipient of those dollars because of their proportionate share of activity at the airport. They are 80% of our operation, which means that they're going to benefit for about $239 million of that $279, and the remaining money will go to the other carriers. If that dynamic should change, that will change the formula and who receives the benefits. But the two largest recipients of this agreement will be Northwest Airlines. The second largest recipient will be Sun Country Airlines, another Minneapolis-St. Paul-based airline. It's all proportionate to the amount of activity and the service that they provide to the community. We believe it does make some sense. With that, Madam Chair, unless the Chair Landers would like to speak to a few of these issues, I'm going to stop talking and let Tom Anderson, counsel, answer questions you may have related to the litigation that's currently underway, or possibly Chair Landers would like to speak to some of the issues that he thinks is of concern. I must tell you that Chair Lanners is unusual in that he's the first chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission to personally engage himself in the details of these negotiations. And, in fact, he chaired the negotiations with the airlines from August all the way through the end of the year and is, the father of this agreement from the standpoint of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Madam Chair.
Chair Lanners.
Chair Lanners, did you wish to make some brief comments?
Madam Chair, if you please. Thank you, Jeff.
If you would identify yourself for the record.
Jack Lanners, Chair of the Metropolitan Airport Commission.
Mr. Lanners.
Glad to be here. Just a couple points dealing with this proposal. It's entered, we're entering into this and negotiated the Memorandum of Understanding for a long-term lease. Private business has been my career, and it is the long-term lease through 2020 that drives the financial stability of the entire airport. It's a foundation of this agreement. A shorter term could be done. This refers to the $100 million total aspect portion of it. A shorter term could be done, but it doesn't accomplish any of the goals and objectives that the airport really should have, which is financial stability. It's financial stability that will help the airport continue to deal with noise issues or other environmental issues that arise in the future or that continue for the programs that we have in place. We need that financial stability to lock in for a 14 or 15-year period our primary tenants and ensure ourselves of debt payments, resolve significant bankruptcy issues that could cost us in and of themselves $25 million a year and more. That could, through a negative relationship with key business partners at the airport, without ramifications to the surrounding businesses, community, Fortune 500 companies, and others that use the airport, a negative relationship could cause some reductions in operations over short-term but also longer-term. We have many funding sources at the airport, including passenger facility charges. Currently, we receive, I believe, $4.50 per emplaned passenger. Being a hub airport has a tremendous benefit for us. We are bringing through approximately 18 million emplanements due to hubbing. That produces quite a bit of dollars for us, just a $4 million per year emplanement reduction due to the hubbing aspects could cost us $18 million a year alone in lost passenger facility charges. This memorandum of understanding resolves many, many issues, almost like a multifaceted spoke of a wheel. And in doing so, sets up the airport and MSP or a long-term financial stable outlook. That, as I say again for Senator Dibble, is important because it puts us in a position and allows us to be able to deal with noise issues or other issues in the future. So I think that's all I have to say and would stand for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Lanners. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Hamill or Chair Lanners or with regard to the litigation to Mr. Anderson? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess whoever wants to answer this, but I guess starting out, whenever I hear statements that give me more questions than answers, I think we're probably on the right page to look at this with more scrutiny. Because I heard that we were doing normal lease negotiation, normal gate negotiations. I don't think this is normal, but it would be fairly simple for MAC, for you, Mr. Hamill, and Mr. Lanners, Chair Lanners, to be able to provide us some documentation. I'm assuming we'll move this up to the full committee, and by that time you can provide us documentation from other hubs that this amount of negotiating and these types of fees and stuff are standard at some of these other hubs so that we know beyond any reasonable doubt that this is in the kind of ballpark that the major airlines are negotiating at other hubs. So if that can be provided to us in a form of documentation, that would be really good, and that would keep us on track as we look at this. Another thing you said, Mr. Hamill, that kind of bothered me, you talked about a great deal of time would take for us to understand these issues. And that makes me think, if it would take us so much time to understand these issues of negotiating, why do we have MAC appointees that have no aviation or airport background? Are you then presenting them something that you don't have time to train them in on that they get to vote on too? Because that's very troubling when you talk about it that way. And I'll make a final comment, then you can address them or not, but I think more to give you the ideas of what we're looking for as we look at this piece of legislation. Chair Lanners, you kind of created a negative scenario, but it seemed like it was based on Northwest walking away and nobody coming in to backfill that as a hub, and I think that's kind of an outrageous scenario, and I think that we're looking at this as though if we didn't offer this kind of opportunity to any other airlines, I would think they'd all be jumping at the opportunity to be here in Minnesota. So we talk about competition. We want to grow competition, yet we're giving all the money to one company, and it seems like that kind of defeats competition.
But so I'd love to respond to that, Senator.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Lanners.
Madam Chair.
And we will continue on this subject for another 5 to 10 minutes, and then we have two other bills that I don't think will take a long time, but Senator Dimmel, is that agreeable?
Yes, Madam Chair. I did have some final closing comments and
we'll
some responses to what has been said by the testifiers.
Thank you. Chair Lanners.
Madam Chair. It's difficult to cover all the bases, but realistically, when we're looking at this proposal, a couple of years ago under review, MSP was noted as the in the bottom half of hub airports relative to rates and charges to the airlines. Continues to rate in the top echelon for operations, for use, etc., and that's a good thing. We were about $5 per in-plane passenger. Over the last 2 to 3 years, we are moving up into the $7 per in-plane passenger cost to airlines. In the meantime, we have other airports that have been moving from the $7 range that are in direct competition with us down to $5. That's not a good trend. We're not exactly on the key routes to everywhere in the world here. And while we're a wonderful place to be, we need to do our best to be competitive. And that's a driving factor here. Certainly the bankruptcy of Northwest Airlines and Delta and others, but primarily Northwest here at MSP, is a driving motivator, but there are other motivators. When it comes to competition, this memorandum of understanding consolidates what we have as short-term gates. We have a short-term gate in the Lindbergh terminal here. We have one over there. This consolidates a half a dozen short-term gates on the D-pod. If anyone uses the airport, the D-pod is very, very convenient. To the right-hand side, you go in, you go past the new French Meadow Bakery, Ike's, and Rock Bottom Brewery restaurants, and you hit the D-pod. And there's 6 contiguous gates, short-term, that are available to us. That's a great attraction, along with reduced rates and charges, to try and bring additional competitive services to MSP. Keep in mind, we do have 5 home-based operations operating out of MSP right now, some of which are Northwest-related, Northwest Airlines, Masaba, the New Compass, and also Sun Country and Champion. I think that's an unprecedented number in the industry in the United States, or very close to it. That's a good thing, and that also helps drive competition. We hope that we can get more expansion by Sun Country Airlines. So when it comes to competition, In a bankruptcy filing, the negative outlook, and it's I've always learned you do have to look at the worst case scenario because it can't happen. And with loan rejections due to bankruptcy, with lease rejections, and if you put yourself in the position of any corporation, what are the things that you would do, that you would have to do, or that the bankruptcy creditors committee or others would force you to do? And those could include the airline lease agreement rejection. with an airline lease agreement rejection, we end up with somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 open gates. Are we going to toss Northwest Airlines or any other airline from all those gates? I really don't think so. That would not benefit the people of Minnesota or the Twin Cities area or the businesses. So that not being viable, what do we do with 100 gates? Well, I'll guarantee you, you're right, we could attract people in here, and I'll bet we could fill 10 to 20 of them pretty fairly darn quick. Now, they're going to want incentives to fill them. They're going to want various attractive things in order to come in here and fill those gates. And so when we talk the complexities, yes, there are. But I think we've accomplished the competitive issues that we're looking to accomplish by consolidation of gates and those types of things. We're locking in a long-term lease with our top payers that ensure our revenue stream and ensure that we will not be going to the citizens of Minnesota for bonding. Keep our top-rated bond ratings that MSP has had historically, unlike virtually any other airport. There's just a handful at most of airports in the United States that have the bond ratings that we have. We want to keep it that way. This provides the stability to do so. It needs to be done in an expedited manner due to bankruptcy issues. So it does all tie together.
Madam Chair, if I may respond specifically to Senator Jungbauer's remark, to a couple of his comments. Number one, we will provide the committee with examples of other airport lease negotiation processes around the country, and I think you'll find it to be a fairly common practice, particularly during this time of kind of airline bankruptcy over the last 3 to 4 to 5 years. Chicago, Denver, Memphis, Detroit, Minneapolis, there's a broad cross-section variety of examples we can provide. Number two, regarding the time constraints and time issue, once a commission has been appointed to the Airports Commission and will serve a four-year term, we spend significant time briefing commissioners and preparing them on the finances, the negotiation, the relationships, and the operation of the airport. That kind of concentrated briefing process and so forth, plus the debate and discussion that takes place in committee meetings as well as the full commission meeting, does prepare a commissioner to be able to move forward in these negotiation processes. And quite frankly, in the course of negotiation, they do broaden their knowledge and exposure and experience. And my suggestion was not that the legislature is not capable of or not willing or able, but that it is a significant time commitment to get into these issues, to understand the consequences and the nuances, and to quite frankly go through the financial models and so forth to take a look at the outcome, certain decisions and scenarios. It's a commitment of time that is a substantial amount of focus, but certainly doesn't mean that you couldn't do it. And finally, Chair, an important point. If Northwest Airlines is not successful in its efforts to come out of bankruptcy, hopefully during the second quarter of this year, if this company were to liquidate and that hub were to disappear, it is my judgment, and it can be argued, it's my judgment that there would not be another hub airline coming to the Twin Cities, that we would find ourselves with 13 or 14 or 15 carriers that would distribute the traffic across the board. We would not have the concentration of passenger activity. We would not have the connecting passenger traffic that attracts the number of routes and structures and nonstop destination points. We would definitely see, in my judgment, a decline and a reduction in the level of service and the quality of service offered out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hamill and Chair Lanners. And I do want to compliment Chair Lanners because out of the people that I've seen on the commission over the years and stuff, I think he's done yeoman's work to be able to just study things, whether it's our reliever airports that he took charge of, and to really study what's going on at MSP. So I think we got the right guy in charge. And you know, I'm just one of those skeptical guys. Show me the paperwork. Show me the trail. And I do think us legislators, you got to educate us. But if you think we're moving in the wrong direction here, I think what you've laid out here, there should be enough documentation that says you guys have done your homework. And we need to know that. Then we'll probably leave you alone.
No, we won't leave them alone.
Please don't.
I will point out before I call on Senator Carlson that the issues of the MAC itself and its governance, as well as airport noise, is under the although they're being heard here and in transportation, it's actually under the jurisdiction of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, and probably that's where the bill should have gone first and then to transportation second. But we, if the Transportation Committee does act favorably on it as a whole, the bill would be referred to the State and Local Government Committee. Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hamill, I'm from, or I represent Burnsville in Eagan, and in both cases, those cities have registered to me a lot of disappointment with the liaison work between the MAC and the cities. And in my discussions, they've continually asked about, you know, things like noise mitigation. And from what I understand, that noise mitigation had something to do with this this agreement, too, what you're working on here. Is there a reaffirmation of the commitment to do noise mitigation? And also, I think there was some discussion about moving the headquarters, and that the headquarters agreement was going to be, you know, the agreement was going to be that the headquarters was going to be one of the negotiating points also on this this advantage that was given to Northwest.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, let me take it just backwards, just to kind of make it clear. In these discussions, they're long and they're involved, but I have to tell you that these negotiations were not threatening in nature. Northwest Airlines did not at any point in our discussion threaten to downsize the Minneapolis-St. Paul hub, threaten to move their headquarters to some other location. That was not the tone or the tenor of this, of these discussions at all. It truly was an effort on the part of the airline, speaking on behalf of itself and representing other carriers and the Metropolitan Airports Commission, to try to work out some arrangement where we could reduce the overall cost of government to the airlines serving the airport, make the facility more attractive, and quite frankly, secure the financial obligations and the future of Northwest Airlines in this community. But it was not a contentious, threatening environment, and there was never a discussion mentioned by Northwest Airlines of pulling its hub out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul market or reducing its commitment to the community. And so I want to make that very, very clear, that those rumors kind of get out and get a little bit exaggerated in the process. That just did not happen.
Well, Madam Chair, it is important to note in
Senator
thank you, Madam Chair, in public testimony, when those provisions were brought forward by MAC commissioners, Northwest Airlines specifically objected to their inclusion on the public record at the MAC, including an affirmation of commitment to noise obligations.
The noise obligations, however, are the responsibility of MAC and not the Northwest Airlines.
But Madam Chair, Northwest Airlines has the ability to specifically object to the MAC's capital program.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble is correct that there were those concerns expressed. However, I believe, and I won't speak for Northwest, as we said, I believe their comments were focused on the fact that these agreements are already in place in a variety of other documents, and they felt it necessary to reiterate all those previous commitments and obligations. Not worthy of a great deal of discussion here. I have to simply say to Senator Carlson, there was never a threat to pull out of the market or to leave the marketplace. Secondly, regarding noise, first of all, we at the Commission fully recognize that there has been a significant change in the noise environment south of the airport and communities that you represent. The opening of runway 1735, with the focus of traffic departing toward the south from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and traffic arriving from the south to land on the airport runways to the north, have placed traffic over the south suburban communities of Burnsville, Eagan, South Bloomington, Lakeville, Apple Valley, in a way that you've not seen in the past. There was a disconnect, I guess is a word I would use, between the FAA, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and the communities regarding how that runway was going to be utilized, and specifically there was a disagreement regarding a specific turn over the Minnesota River. Since the opening of the runway and since the operations began, the Airports Commission has joined hands with the communities and challenged the FAA to modify their operating rules and their procedures. And I'm pleased, if you're not aware of it, Senator, that that those rules have been modified. And, in fact, the airport's currently in a 60-day test cycle to try to modify that southbound heading to turn more toward the west, which was what was alluded to in the discussions prior to the opening of the runway. Bottom line is that we're making progress. The airline companies are in compliance with procedure. The FAA is broadening its dispersion of traffic to the south of the airport. Fortunately, the aircraft that operate at the airport are becoming increasingly quiet as time goes on, and that means less noise impact directly. And we're seeing a more aggressive replacement of the old noisy airplanes than we anticipated in our forecasting process. So all of these things are happening, which I think is a positive direction. Finally,
Mr. Hamill?
Yes, ma'am.
It's 10 minutes to 11. We have two more bills.
One summary comment, Madam Chair. In response, we understand your interest in having representation on the board. I would suggest that, if possible, it would be worthwhile having a meeting with the MAC commissioner that represents the district. I think it's a matter of kind of a disconnect between the commissioner and the various governments that representative, that person represents, and we can improve that communication definitely. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill, Mr. Lanners, Mr. Anderson. Senator Dibble moves that Senate file 580 be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. Is there further discussion on that motion?
Madam Chair, if I could just summarize.
Senator Dibble, we have two
more
bills.
Chair, we let them go on and on and on, and there are a few points that need to be rebutted.
Senator Dibble.
I'll be very, very brief. I'm not specifically attacking this agreement or specifically criticizing the MAC. I'm not interested in micromanaging the MAC. They do a fine job, and for the most part, the underlying premise and crux of this agreement is sound. And if that's so, there should be nothing to be feared by bringing forward this document for scrutiny. You know, we might look at a mechanism like they've got, have the commission approve an MOU or some of the deal points. And just finally, I just have to say that, there may be some lost opportunities. That's the role of the legislature, in terms of public policy and public benefit. And to the point that, this airport has done more and spent more on noise, that may well be true. But the community bears the cost and bears the burden of keeping this airport at its present site. It's got about, something in the neighborhood of 400 and some thousand operations. It's going to be maxed out at 700 and some thousand operations. That's significant impact on a very very densely built environment that surrounds a very landlocked airport. And that's a part of the agreement that was established in 1996. And this is an opportunity to make good on that agreement. Or to reaffirm the commitment to that agreement. And if we lose those leverage points and those points of opportunity, we haven't done our due diligence on behalf of the public. You see time and again the MAC strikes a defensive posture when we bring these ideas and these suggestions forward on behalf of and in defense of the major carrier at the site. And I think the MAC's role is somewhat different than simply defending the interests of Northwest Airlines. It has a public role, and I don't see that being carried out right now.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 580 be recommended, pass, and refer to the full committee. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, the next bill we'll be looking at is Senate File 958. It's actually listed as our last bill. Senator Rest comes to the table if you want to grab the language for Senate File 958.
Chairman and members, I will be very brief. We can hear this bill in the committee. I do have an author's amendment. It is the A1 amendment. Mr. Chairman, I move amendment.
And this is the first time this, yes, okay. It's the first time this bill has been heard, so it's an author's amendment. Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn to Parker at this point to just give us a brief overview of the Senate File 958. The other bill we have, we needed to have an amendment drafted in its proper form, and it will be coming from the council's office momentarily. So that's why we're going to take this bill up just and out of order. So, Ms. Parker, if you don't mind, if you could be very brief, we want to deal with both bills before we go up to session.
Ms. Parker, your briefest version.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I'll be very brief. Section 1 gives the department and local units of government authority to enter private property to do testing of the soils prior to acquisition of the property. We already have this authority for survey work and for environmental remediation, and this statute simply gives us the authority to do the same procedure for the use of soil investigations. It helps us in the process of siting highway projects and prevents delay of the project if we discover problems later. Section 3 addresses bridge inspections and provides that bridges that are classified as culverts may be inspected at intervals as long as 4 years if they are in good condition. This is consistent with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials and with federal policies governing management of bridges. Section 4 addresses the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program and makes what are basically technical and housekeeping changes to the statute that authorizes the Commissioner of Transportation to make loans to rail carriers and to shippers organizations for the improvement of rail lines. Section 5 addresses the rail bank program in the state of Minnesota. Right now, the department has authority to lease or sell unused rail bank property as long as we retain a rail bank corridor no less than 50 feet. It has become clear that we need to retain a width of a corridor at 100 feet. This change is prospective only so that in the future we would retain 100-foot corridors. It wouldn't affect anything we own now. And then the last section of the bill, Section 6, provides, with respect to the rail bank property, a list of things that people may not do on rail bank property that is almost identical to the list of things they may not do on trunk highways, such as obstruct a trail, obstruct ditch draining devices, erect fences, destroy right-of-way markers, drive on it in inappropriate places, abandon vehicles on it, and it makes those violations a misdemeanor, just as presently exists for highways. We're not aware of any opposition or controversy about any portion of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. And members, Section 4, 5, and 6 all deal with rail, and that's really the reason it's before this committee. Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 958 be recommended to pass and refer to.
Senator Rest has recommended Senate File 958 to pass. Any questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman, you may want to ask if there's anybody here other than Ms. Parker who wants to make a comment on the bill.
Is anybody here to testify about Senate File 958? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senate File 958 to pass and moving on to the main committee? As amended. Thank you. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Senate File 958 passes as amended. Senator Rest, Senate File 218.
Mr. Chairman, has the amendment come up?
The amendment is not here. Maybe you want to give a quick explanation.
Mr. Chairman, instead, I'm going to request that Senator Murphy just bring this bill back up into the committee and hear it. We had the language sent on Thursday with all snowstorm. It did not to the committee. So I'll make that request and remove it from the agenda for today so we can also get to session on time.
Thank you, Senator Riss. Is there any more business before the committee? Seeing none, committee is adjourned.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
They're probably here now.
He only brought six of them, and we need them for our records. Thank you.
See, I'm trying to think. I may have given them one.
All right. So you might have two.
So. Anybody that'll take paper away from me.
No.
I mean, takes paper away from me is a friend.
Total. So he's updated. It's cold in here.
I like it. I actually like it cold.
So do you have it now? And do you okay.
Get all of your
bills. So we usually.
Billy's just going to say hello.
Oh, yeah.
But I also live on Wilderness Curve. Last time. Driveway last fall or so.
See, on Wilderness Curve.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we should.
You want me to touch these things? Okay, we're good.
Sure. Last house or something?
Yeah.
I think it's the last one before I get to the
Yeah.
Yeah. They're our neighbors, but they found us. Chisholm.
Wait, is that... That's not my stuff, Billy, is it?
I think I left your stuff.
Thanks.
I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Doesn't live there.
So, you know,
she's
in the
back. Said she was...
Yeah.
I mean,
I got to run the session.
Congratulations.
Well, don't blame yourself. And
do you need anything?
Even if you do blame yourself,
nope.
But don't be hard on yourself because, you know, you did a great job. This was probably the first hearing you had to.
Oh, you can have.